Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm Matt, the co-host of the channel. I'm here with Mendel, my co-host, and today we'll be talking to Cynthia Baker about her new book, Jew, part of the Key Words in Jewish Studies series from Rutgers University Press. Cynthia Baker, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Our first question is just, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and then about how you came to write this book, especially given how expansive it is in both breadth and depth?
Okay. Well, again, thank you for having me. I'm a professor of religious studies at Bates College, a small liberal arts college in Lewiston, Maine. I teach all the Judaism classes and pre-modern Christianity in our tiny but fabulous four-person small liberal arts department. Jew is my second book. My first was entitled Rebuilding the House of Israel, Architectures of Gender in Jewish Antiquity. That book explored rabbinic constructions of women and women's bodies in conversation with larger domestic, local, and imperial spaces, Roman imperial spaces. It worked on developing appropriate and effective ways to read material culture and texts together. So trying to synthesize ways, more sophisticated ways than I had received as a graduate student, in thinking about how texts and archaeology, material culture, could be brought together to think about things like gender, power, place. So I came to write this book, Jew, actually, in response to an invitation by Andrew Bush, a scholar at Vassar College. And I've actually never met him or even spoken to him by phone. We've just had sort of an email relationship for several years now. But one day, completely out of the blue, quite a number of years ago, he wrote me a fan letter after reading my first book. And that's the first fan letter I had ever received and the only one he says that he had ever written. A few years later, he became one of the three editors, along with Deborah Dash Moore and Mac Moore, of Rutgers' Key Words in Jewish Studies series. And so I was in his Rolodex, as it were, on his mind as somebody who might be a good author for this series. And he contacted me to ask me if there were a word in the entire field of Jewish studies about which I could imagine writing an entire book. So given my previous book on space, on place, on architectural material built environment, I, you know, immediately said, well, you know, I could certainly write on space and place. But it turned out that Barbara Mann had just recently completed a doctoral dissertation on that subject, and she had already snatched that subject. And I should say the resulting book is really, really marvelous. So I went back to the drawing board, looked over my other research interests at the time, and was really struck by how the term Jew was a thread that was already running through a number of them. My article, When Jews Were Women, had recently been published at the time, and that grew out of my noticing in my studies of Mishnah that the word Jew almost never appeared, and then when it did appear, it seemed to always be in the context of discussions of women and women's transgressions. And I was struck by that sort of coincidence, if you will. So that's how the book, that's how I came to take on this project. And I was also at a point in my career where I was anxious to take on a challenge, to really, you know, use my next project to expand my knowledge base and take some intellectual risks. I wanted to go exploring well beyond my comfort zone and expertise, which was is primarily in antiquity, but also modern historiography. So I just took a deep breath and plunged into Jew.
I can say we're certainly grateful, and I feel like you can almost think of this as our fan letter to you in a way.
That's very sweet. Thank you.
So we're hoping you could tell us a little bit more about the term Jew, about what you, why you decided to sort of entitle the book Jew. And you describe the project of the book as the exploration of, quote, the significance and implications of a single key insight regarding the word Jew. Could you just tell us a little bit more about what this insight is and perhaps why you think it's so important and fundamental for Jewish studies?
Okay. Well, the fact that the series in which the book was to be published was called Key Words in Jewish Studies gave me permission to treat the word itself as my subject matter. Now, saying that, I should be clear that other authors in the series have approached their words and subject matters differently. They're not all sort of word fixated in the way that I ended up being. So other titles in the series are, the series started with a book titled Jewish Studies itself, and other volumes in the series are Jewish Families, Haskalah, Holocaust, Jewish Peoplehood, Space and Place, as I mentioned. And the next volume coming out in October from Daniel Boyarin will take on Judaism. So I did Jew. He's doing Judaism. We'll see how they speak to each other or completely diverge. I've read parts of the manuscript, but not the whole thing. Anyway, I was personally drawn and took the mission of the series as that kind of permission to focus on the word itself, in part because, as you say, the expansiveness of the subject matter, you could easily drown in you know, that sea of material. So I found that by maintaining a disciplined focus on the word itself, that disciplined focus created a kind of boundary that paradoxically gave me all kinds of license to think creatively and capaciously within the limits circumscribed by that boundary. Once I was sort of within those constraints that gave me, as I said, paradoxically a kind of freedom, I became particularly intrigued by the realization that, and here's the sort of single point around which the book revolves that you mentioned, and I'll just quote how I put it in the introduction. I was struck by the realization that, quote, those identified as Jews have not, in fact, owned the word Jew or controlled the discourse about it or even much used the term for most of the past 2,000 years, unquote. So then I begin to wonder, so who did own this word and what did they do with it? And the short answer is, obviously, Jew was became a major building block of Christian self-understanding. And given the Christian West, Jew becomes really foundational to the contours of Western culture writ large. But then what's the process by which Christian meanings and the power of naming became ultimately contested? Here I am in the 21st century, in the 20th and 21st century, using Jew. I'm in Jewish studies. I'm using Jew as a taken for granted term of identification. Millions of people self-identify by this term in all kinds of contexts. And yet it also remains an unreconstructed epithet in others, or very, you know, an obvious term for other, Charlottesville, being a very recent example of this usage. So, you might also remember several years ago when if you did a Google internet search on Jew, and I talk about this in my book, the first page of results was pretty much all hate groups. And that actually became a thing, that became a story in itself, the fact that you could Google the word Jew and your first results page was all stuff from hate groups. And then they put up a disclaimer on the page saying, you know, yes, we understand these are, how did they put it, very disturbing results, and encouraged people who really wanted to know about Jews or Judaism to look up Judaism or Jewish people or even Jews plural instead of the word Jew, which seemed to really be, you know, have a lock on it by these hate groups in this respect. So in any case, that's one really great example of how those who self-identify as Jews don't really get to own or control the term. In fact, quite the opposite still is the case. So I was really curious to look at that whole sweep from the early years of Christian use of the term. So Jew is much more frequently used in the New Testament, for example, the Christian scriptures, than it is in at all in the Jewish scriptures, the Hebrew Bible, the Torah, the Old Testament. So that pattern just really captured my imagination and became sort of the core insight of the book.
That example is also so interesting. I don't actually remember when that was happening on Google, but it was a sort of reading the book, it was an example that sort of tied together, you know, the sort of early antiquity examples that you were talking about with, you know, present day discourses in a way that was sort of, I thought, really powerful. So
thank you. Yeah. It as I said, I think you can hear in my voice, even after all these years of wading through this material, I still find it really intriguing and compelling. This word and the dynamics around it continues to be fascinating to me.
You just described a really fascinating example, and we were both interested, especially because the book spans antiquity to the present day. We were wondering if you could describe your research process a bit. You focus on the word Jew, but how did you go about choosing your examples? Were there examples that you decided to leave out that were especially difficult to leave out?
Good question.
This is like a pertinent question. This is a pertinent question for us too, as graduate students who are sort of embarking on this process and trying to figure out how to compose these narratives. So no pressure.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure. Well, I'm not sure how helpful this will be, but I'll tell you about my process, and you'll see why I'm not sure it's replicatable. But so in this book, I really did let myself be guided by the structures envisioned and by the series editors. So Keywords in Jewish Studies, the series calls for a three-part division. And the three parts, they actually give you the names or the rubrics for the three parts. Terms of the debate is the first part. State of the question is the second part. And the third is something they call in a new key. And they ask you to use this three-part division. Some of the books, you know, really use that as a structuring principle, and they tell you, you know, what they broadly have in mind, and others completely ignore it. I think I actually, again, just like putting those constraints of keeping my focus on the word Jew itself, I found that sort of really using what was suggested to me, or how these each of these three divisions made me think about my material and helped me structure it. I really did find that very useful. The editors of the series also suggested that the books could form the content of the books could form a historical arc or some kind of thematic sequencing. And my book does start with antiquity and end with the genomic era. So I do have that kind of historical arc built in, but I decided pretty early on that I really didn't have the stomach for or any desire to do anything resembling conventional historiography. I actually had sort of a physical, I don't know, as I say, I just didn't have the stomach for when I thought of writing a conventional historiography, I just became bone weary. And it's like, I can't do this. I don't want to do this. So where did that leave me? I basically had to either invent a genre for this book or to mix and blend and bend existing genres to ask the questions and create the frameworks for the kinds of things that I wanted to know about. So part one, I wanted to think about origins and categories, those sort of basic building blocks, those basic stories and narratives. The history and contemporary historiography around this word. So I wanted to, or needed to perhaps, write about the origins of the word, but then that necessity spawned a more meta-reflection on the whole quest for origins and how narratives of origins work to constitute, legitimate, maintain particular identities and political agendas, right? So I also knew that I had to address, so there was that piece, that origins piece, and how narratives of origins do work, do political, ideological work in the contemporary world. So that was the first piece I really wanted to grapple with in part one. And then there was the whole Judean question, and we can talk about that more fully later if you'd like. So there was this whole Judean debate going on in studies of Jewish antiquity. And finally, I wanted to take on the question of these categories, Jew as an ethnic versus religion category. Right. So again, these sort of big, broad, fundamental, categorical and historical questions, which it turns out. And so this question of ethnicity versus religion is deeply interwoven in the Judean debate and the quest for origins in really interesting ways. So part one was more, I guess, of what you could call a genealogy or a sort of laying foundations chapter. And so those were my questions. I don't really think I have, wasn't really using examples in the way that you're asking about, you know, how did I choose my examples? It really was this, this sort of genealogy of Christian appropriation of the term, of scholarly debates about its antiquity and origins and so forth. So that's terms of the debate.
If I may, one thing I really appreciated about that chapter was it felt, as someone who doesn't really study antiquity at all, it felt like I got such a good presentation of what was going on and what was happening amongst scholarly debates, but also that you were making such a strong and compelling argument about what was happening, and sort of reading through both of those was really thrilling, I would say. Can you just sort of make clear for our listeners what your argument is and how you view those, some of those scholarly debates?
In part one?
In part one, yeah.
Okay, in part one. So, so the Judean debate, and which also becomes the sort of ethnicity versus religion debate, broadly summarized would be, well, so there's emerged over the past few decades this growing practice in studies of late antiquity of translating the Greek word eudaios and the Hebrew word Yehudi, Aramaic Yehudai, these ancient terms in ancient texts as Judean. They've traditionally been translated as Jew. Judaios is Jew. But recently, scholars have been making the case for translating them as Judean, and avoiding translating them as Jew in English language scholarship. But the sort of scholarly rationales for this shift from translating as Jew to translating as Judean, actually the rationales given really run a wide gamut of reasoning, with some scholars talking about, you know, up to within a certain time period, we should translate it Judean, and then after this time period, we should translate as Jew. Some scholars in these debates insist on a narrowly geographic and primarily adjectival use of Judean, but many, I would say most, have come to describe what they see as a kind of evolution from an earlier period of Judean-ness. Judeans roamed the face of the Fertile Crescent, to a developmentally later period that saw the emergence of Jews from this Judean seedbed. So perplexingly, this period of emergence of Jews, some scholars identify it as occurring as early as the era of the biblical patriarchs. Others say this is, you know, Judeans become Jews in the period of the Babylonian Empire. Others, Shia Cohen in particular, says, no, we see the shift from Judeans to Jews during the Hasmonean Empire in the 2nd century BCE. Babylonian is more 6th century BCE. And then others say, no, we have Judeans right up into the Christian era, and it's really with the consolidation of Christianity that we no longer have Judeans. We start having Jews, in which case Jew is largely a function of, you know, Christian hegemony and Christian. So what's the difference between Judean and Jew? So another perplexing aspect of this debate is the fact that different scholars in different schools of thought give different reasons for avoiding the word Jew or for using a bifurcated terminology, Judean versus Jew. So the majority assert that the distinction between Judean the Judean names an ethnic group, an ethnogeographic entity. Judeans are an ethnogeographic entity, what we would now term sociologically, I think, is a kind of secular category, right? So now we're also getting into secular versus religious modern scholarship. So the secular ethnogeographic category versus Jew, which names a practitioner of a religion, the religion of Judaism, or the practitioner, an adherent of a religiously defined social group. So some scholars, so that's one way in which it gets divided, right? There's a difference between being an ethnogeographic entity and being a religious entity. And so I take on why that's a really problematic argument to make. Other scholars cite the long history of Christian derogation of the word Jew, and they express a desire to circumvent that history by verbally distinguishing Judeans as a pre-Christian identity from Jews of later eras. So, for example, in the Greek-English lexicon of the New Testament and other early Christian literature, they go out of their way to say, let's see, I should quote this. They say, quote, incalculable harm has been caused by simply glossing Judaios with Jew. For many readers or auditors of the Bible translations do not practice the historical judgment necessary to distinguish between circumstances and events of an ancient time and contemporary ethnic, religious, social realities, with the result, I'm still quoting, with the result that anti-Judaism in the modern sense of the term is needlessly fostered through biblical texts, unquote. So then they go on to translate all of these New Testament texts, which were you know, if you read the New Testament, it's all about, you know, the Jews did this and the Jews did that. But somehow now making Jesus, his followers and his detractors all Judeans ameliorates the anti-Judaism, if you will, the ability to use the New Testament in the present day as a as authorizing prejudice against or antagonism toward Jews. So that was a bit more than a sort of a quick summary. But so we have the Jew-Judean ethnicity versus religion, or we don't want to continue, you know, the negative associations that Christianity has really heaped upon Jews and Jewishness for millennia. And so we're going to change the translation of these ancient texts so that modern readers won't think they're talking about those nasty Jews in Jesus' time. They're talking about Judeans. We don't know what that means, but it's not the same as my Jewish neighbor.
Yeah.
Does that work?
No, it's
does
really,
that,
I, okay. No,
more
no,
than you
I
asked
mean, it's,
for, but.
We're both really interested in like, in really fascinating ways, you interrogate some of the secular categories that are being used to describe antiquity, for example. And Mendel and I have discussed how we might situate your work in contemporary studies of religion. And we're both interested, you mentioned earlier genealogy, and we were wondering if you could say how your work is or isn't in dialogue with Talal Asad's genealogy of religion. Earlier, you also mentioned Daniel Boyarin, and he seems to be interested in a very particular kind of philology. And we're wondering if you could locate your own project within scholarship or within a cultural history today. What kind of critical dialogue do you see yourself participating in, or what kind of dialogue do you hope to start? And I might add, these are the kinds of questions you also pose to the material you're working with. So we were wondering if we're taking a cue from your own book here.
Okay. I'll answer. I don't really have a good answer to that question, but I'll give it a shot. We can maybe circle back to, you asked about my method earlier, and I think that also gives a sense of who I perhaps, you know, what I'm doing, who I understand myself to be in dialogue with, because my method in part one that we just have spent this time talking about, the questions and the methods for part one, are very different from what I did in part two and part three of the book, which moved, you know, much more expressly beyond my original expertise or my original sort of scholarly location. But I'll try to answer this question. I tend not to be all that good about being self-reflective about who I am and how I function within sort of larger scholarly conversations.
I guess that's
but,
our job, isn't it?
What comes to mind? Yeah. what comes to mind in response to your question is a comment by an anonymous peer reviewer of the manuscript when it was, you know, it still had to go, even though it was commissioned in a sense, it still had to go through a peer review process. And, an anonymous reviewer wrote something to the effect that the first section of this book seems aimed toward scholars of religion. Part two seems aimed toward Jewish studies scholars, and part three feels like it's more for social scientists. And then this review went on to suggest that the closest text, because when you're reviewing a book manuscript, I don't know if you've done this yet, but when you're reviewing a book manuscript, they ask you what else is out there like this. What is, you know, what it, are there competing titles? What is this? And so this reviewer went on to suggest that the closest set of texts to Jew would be the work of Gil Adnajar. Okay, his Semites and secularism and blood, again, these big themes, but But then the reviewer said Baker's book is infinitely more accessible and said that's a compliment, while not sacrificing any intellectual rigor. So personally, I would love to be able to read and make sense of Gil Anajar's books. They seem so interesting and important, but I've just never been able to decipher them. And that's on me, of course. That's not on Gil or anyone else, because I'm having difficulty, understanding what's going on in books like that. And I'll admit it took me years to get past the first few pages of Judith Butler's Gender Trouble. But if you've read the book, so you know, I think I do okay by Judith Butler now. That's what comes to mind when you ask about, and clearly I am very much in dialogue with that first part of the book. I'm very much in dialogue with people like Daniel Boyarin and Denise Buell, and I'm really not good at pulling names out of the air. Andrew Jacobs, and there's actually a whole conversation that I'm aware of. I know my conversation partners in antiquity. In the other parts of the book, I'm more in dialogue with. Well, for example, in part two. Just to go back to your first question, part two, my two challenges were I really had to learn new material and find new conversation partners, because one of the tasks I set myself in part two was, so having said that Jews have not owned or really much used the word Jew for most of the past two millennia, up until the modern era, where people who self-identify as Jews come to appropriate that term in the dominant vernaculars of Western Europe, of the Mediterranean, and so forth. The one real exception that I had to deal with, and that really seemed to potentially blow my thesis out of the water, is the word yid, the Yiddish word yid. So the Yiddish word yid, if you look in any dictionary or any, you know, if you look at Yiddish studies, yid translates as Jew. So here are a bunch of Yiddish speakers calling each other yid, calling each other Jew. So that gives a lie to my original thesis. So I really had to grapple with that question, which I do in part two. So my interlocutors there, I'm not a scholar of Yiddish, and that's something that's obvious, I think, in there. So I really had to find interlocutors and conversation partners who were thinking, or whose work gave me a way of asking the questions that I wanted to ask about how that word yid functions in Yiddish culture, what it is about Yiddish culture and its use of the word yid that is and is not like the way in which Jew in dominant non-Jewish languages functions. So yid is Jew in Yiddish, but Yid in Yiddish does not function at all in the same way that the word Jew functions in dominant vernaculars. So that's I'm exploring that for a chunk of part two. That's my exploration. So then again, so there my conversation partners are completely different in a sense. Naomi Seidman was a huge help in that, because she thinks about translation. She thinks and writes about translation. So I really found I'm gathering around me conversation partners that help to take me and my thinking where I want to go, whether the book as a whole fits within any kind of scholarly paradigm or genre or larger conversation. Well, a way to answer that question would be to say, as you know, the book was the subject of a marginalia forum, and I was really thrilled and honored when that came to pass. My conversation partners or the community of scholars and scholarship around this book, I think, is beautifully, wonderfully represented in that forum, for which I'm really, really grateful. And here I'm blanking on names again, Shaul Magid and I can see her face. What's her name? The two scholars who pulled together that forum.
Oh, Annette.
Help me out here.
Yeah, Annette
Yoshiko Reed. Yes, yeah. Wonderful, wonderful scholars in their own right, and the two who pulled together that forum. So that's another way of answering your question about, I think there are a whole. But because I wanted to do so many different things with this book and sought out interlocutors, a whole range of different conversations and different conversation partners find their way into this book at different places and in different ways. I don't know if that really answers your question, but that's my answer.
No, yeah, that's amazing. And we actually just had Nomi Seidman at the University of Chicago, so it's an interesting overlap there. Could you say a bit more about the second part of the book, which is primarily about Yiddish, or at least in large part about Yiddish? What is it exactly about Yid that counters the overarching claim of the book, and how did you resolve that difference, or is it something that just doesn't fit within the paradigm overall? Is it... Could you just say a bit more about the argument of the second essay or the second chapter?
Okay, so this is so part two of the book is in three parts. Within part two, there are three parts. Part one focuses on this question of the word Yid in Yiddish, and I guess what I really came to understand. With the help of Naomi Seidman and Sandra Gilman and others, is that Yid in a Yiddish context is not at all the same thing as Jew in the context of larger discourses. So for example, if you want to ask. How do I boil down everything I do in that Yiddish part? Basically, what I came to realize was that that in Yiddish, the word Yid functions in such a way. In Yiddish, being a Jewish language, an internal Jewish language, a language that is neither coherent to nor used by. The dominant hegemonic cultures within which Yiddish-speaking Jews lived and moved. So Yiddish-speaking Jews had to be bilingual or trilingual, right? So they lived in within larger hegemonic cultures and were part of them. I really want to resist this sort of, host culture and, perpetual exile model, because I think that's deeply problematic as well. But Jews really did, Yiddish speaking Jews really had to spoke Yiddish in some contexts and spoke the dominant vernacular in other contexts. So they were two completely different linguistic worlds. So in Yiddish, the term Yid largely simply means man. Person, human being, in a very specifically Yiddish context. Whereas, as we know, if you say Yid in an English context, in the English context, or you say Zhid in Russian, you almost say it spitting, right? Yid. Yeah. It's derogatory. Not at all. It practically means mensch in right. Yiddish. So if you wanna the first section of that my discussion of Yiddish in part two. The subtitle is Vos Mach Dayid. So just simply to ask, how are you doing, one Yiddish speaker to another, how are you doing, literally translates as, what's a Jew doing? Whereas if you walked up to somebody and said in English, yo, Jew, how's it going? Right? You're not saying the same thing at all as, yo, bro, how's it going? Right? So that's really, there's a fundamental difference between speaking, between speaking an insider language and how the word Yid functions in that insider context versus the way in which the term Jew or Jid or Judeo, you know, in any of the other sort of dominant vernaculars, the word Jew functions. It's you know, the N word in English is, that's not a good analogy, but to some extent it works, right? Who gets to use that term, but who gets to use the N word, right? If you're using it, if you're Black and using it within a Black community context, it's very different than if you are part of the white hegemony and using that term, even if you want to use it in a sort of ally, if you're trying to use it as an ally, it just doesn't work, right? The difference, the fundamental difference there, of course, is that the N word never has been and still isn't a sort of taken for granted everyday term the way the word Jew is. You know, Jew is not a fundamentally or originally derogatory term in the same way. I mean, it is and it isn't, right? So it's an imperfect analogy.
Right.
So
if I can just give a quick anecdote that I think confirms the argument. I was in a Yiddish class a couple of years ago with a native speaker who grew up in Poland. And she would say, as a matter of course, was macht der Yid, right? You know, how are you doing? And then in a contemporary Yiddish language course, you have many non-Jews, and she would keep correcting herself, and she would kind of stumble over it as it became a problem in an interesting ways, that totally idiomatic phrase in kind of the, as you say, like an internal speech community. And then when it's put in a secular context, it gets all, it becomes more difficult in interesting ways.
Right. So yeah, you can say they're Yid, you know. I give an example of you know, you can politely say, you know, please, will the gentleman stand, you know, will the gentleman please sit down? And you can say that in Yiddish using they're Yid for the gentleman or the whereas if you said, yo, could that Jew please sit down? it simply doesn't translate. So I think my original insight about Jews not use it. So I had to, this nuances the sort of broad Jews don't use the word Jew for most of the past 2,000 years to describe themselves, absolutely continues to hold in the vernacular. They don't own it. Mm. They don't use it. It's a word that's used by the hegemonic culture to talk about its other, to talk about the other. But then when we start getting into the modern period, 18th, 19th, 20th centuries, we do start seeing an appropriation of the term Jew as a name for self by people who self-identify as Jew. But that's a rocky road. You know, you're taking on a name for self that has for 2,000 years been a name for other, been a name for devil, been a name for, you know, not us, not self. And then, you know, the dynamics of modernity, of the rise of secularism, of the Enlightenment, of whatever, you know, dynamics you want to point to in the last few centuries, part of those dynamics is appropriation of Jew in dominant vernaculars as a name for self, and still a rocky one, still a conflicted, still a problematic laden, fraught. I'm teaching a Jewish studies course right now. I'm teaching a course on gender and Judaism right now at Bates. And a couple of my young undergraduate students in that course, I have Jewish students and non-Jewish students, students who identify as Jews and students who don't. And some of the non-Jewish students came in and said, yeah, until I signed up for this course, I literally didn't know that Jew wasn't, that you could say Jew in polite company. I didn't know that. I thought it was only, something that polite people didn't say. So, these are 18, 19, 20 year old kids. So it's still very much that fraught term.
I actually remember right as I was reading the book for the first time, and I was discussing it with someone, and they were like, oh, how would you react if someone called you a Jew? And I was like I was unsure initially of what my reaction would be. And then literally, I think the next day or a few days later, I was at an event and I introduced myself to someone. I was like, oh, my name's Mendel, which for those who knows a sort of recognizably Jewish name. And this person asked me, they're like, oh, are you a Jew? And I had this sort of like visceral negative reaction to that question. And they had meant it in almost like as a manner of like solidarity. Like, I'm Jewish too. Like, we should be friends. I don't know what. I reacted so strongly against it. And it was just interesting as I was reading this book sort of to have that in mind and to see the way in which that word functions.
Right. And I don't know if you know about the, I have not had a New York Times book review, although I would certainly welcome one of my book, but it did get, it did, or a New York review of books or New York, there was an op-ed, several months ago, that gave a shout out to my book, and it was all about, yes, we Jews should appropriate this word Jew and stop flinching at it and stop letting it be that kind of weaponized language. And we can do this by calling ourselves and each other Jews. And I gather my book was sort of an impetus towards this writer, Oppenheimer, coming to write this op-ed for the New York Times.
That's interesting, though, because so many of the examples you discussed in the later half of the book, and you sort of alluded to this already about the sort of tricky or difficult nature of reappropriating that word for oneself. And some of the examples are such subtle or ironic or interesting representations that don't sort of easily or clearly fall out as we need to restake our claim to this word. So I don't know what to make of that. Just an interesting to see how it gets taken up in the New York Times op-ed pages, maybe, and how some artists or writers or thinkers are sort of dealing with that question.
Right. You don't actually get to, once you put your baby out in the world, you don't get to, control how it's appropriate at all. Although I have to say, there was a really nice, review, in, I guess it was Anti-Semitism Studies. Robert Erlewine wrote a lovely review of the book. And he actually referred to my book as a bracing and salubrious tonic to a tendency in Jewish studies to try to find the one authentic Judaism or to advance particular agendas, on the part of the Jewish community, which, so he was really struck by, or he characterized my book as not easily lending itself on agenda or another in that regard. As you say, I really live with and try to stay with the tensions, I don't try to resolve them. I try to explore them. I try to understand them. I try to highlight, these sort of inherent tensions and ironies and complexities of this term without you know, which is kind of the opposite of the whole who is a Jew thing.
Right.
You know, if you conform to this, you're a Jew. If you don't, you're not. And, you know, who gets to decide? And, oh, that was so you asked me a ways back, you asked me what I left out of the book. I had no problem leaving that part. I gesture towards it once or twice, but I had no problem leaving out any kind of long-winded discussion of the whole who is a Jew.
That's right.
You know.
So I have a question that's actually, I think, maybe inspired by Naomi Seidman's response to you in that Marginalia forum. And the question is that part of your argument is that Jew or Jews have sort of occupied this privilege, I don't know privilege, but this position of other, of the other against which Christianity and the Christian West has sort of defined itself. And I'm just, I wonder how unique you think this story is specifically about Jew and Jews. Is it a privileged story in some ways, or is it the unique other of the West? And what do you think it would mean if we sort of included other narratives about otherness, or how does Jew relate to Muslim, for example? And would you see that as a sort of potentially interesting way for even pushing this conversation that you've started even further?
Yeah, good question. So I would say Jew is a unique other, not the unique other, yeah, but a unique other in the development of what has come to be known as Western culture and history, because it is Christianity's foundational other. Jew is that which must be displaced and delegitimized in order for Orthodox Christianity to stake its theological, ideological claims, right? We know how to read the Hebrew scriptures. Jews don't know how to read their own scriptures. We know they say that the Messiah is coming and that Jesus is the Messiah. Jews are blinded to this. So Jew is Christianity's foundational other, and insofar as Christianity is the substrate of what has become the West, even the secular post-Christian West, it's still, Jew is the most proximate and deeply embedded other to historically Christian Western civilizations. Now, that said, it's obviously not the unique or exclusive other. So it has attributes that are absolutely unique to it. But othering is a multi-form, ongoing, constantly morphing strategy, and we are getting a front row seat on that, you know, with regard to Muslims, Muslim immigrants to Europe and to the United States. We really are absolutely grappling with this same dynamic, these exact same dynamics of othering and of defining a self, which is, you know, an American self or a European self, a French self, a German self, over and against the excluded other. So it's your standard operating procedure for constructing and maintaining group identities. Is othering is your standard operating procedure, and for consolidating power and privilege. So the West, the monolithic West, or all of its little constituent parts, has many others, and each serves a range of purposes in various times and places, and overlap and intersect with others. In really interesting ways, and in ways that are really important to parse out. And as you mentioned, the Marginalia Forum really brought out that aspect of the book, and though some of those potential critiques or ways in which what I do with the word Jew in this book has resonances, has intersections, has implications far beyond Jewish studies per se, far beyond examination of the word Jew. And as you know, another part of chapter two, chapter three, the part three in my book, is devoted to unpacking public discourse, primarily in Europe, although it occasionally pops up in the U.S., more and more so perhaps now, that frames Muslim immigrants of the past few decades as, quote unquote, the new Jews. It's, of course, a contentious label for obvious reasons and a provocative one because it encapsulates so many tensions, so much history, and it conveys a sense of the moral and existential urgency of the situation. Just a day or two ago on the radio, I was hearing a journalist, a story on the radio that made oblique reference to the stakes for Europe in getting this Muslim question right, in a similar way to the way the Jewish question, quote unquote, tore Europe apart in the earlier, in earlier 20th century. So. So I would absolutely say it is a unique example, Jew is a unique other, but by no means the unique other, holds any kind of exclusive or privileged position. Unique historically. But it's one very potent and particular example of this dynamic of othering as a means to creating, consolidating, sustaining privilege and identity. But by no means is it the only. So Michael Pragel's piece for Marginalia, I think, did a really wonderful job tracing out many, many ways in which Jew and Muslim, as you put it, are entangled or intersect with each other in a very visible and visceral way in the present moment.
Yeah, you mentioned a bit earlier that you're teaching a course on Jewish studies and gender at the moment, and Mendel and I have both thought of the book Jew as an incredible resource for teaching Jewish studies. And we're just interested in the ways you approach this material for an undergraduate course. Do you teach Jewish studies always in conversation with other in terms of gender or in terms of space? Do you bring in these political questions of the moment, such as the new Jews? We're just interested in how you would go about approaching Jewish studies in the college setting.
It was literally my first thought as I was reading the book. I was like, oh my gosh, if I were teaching an intro to Jewish studies course, I would almost want to like orient it around this book somehow.
Please do that. First I have to say that Bates doesn't actually have Jewish studies. We don't have a Jewish studies program or a Jewish studies division in our department or located anywhere in the college. I as a Judaist, was hired to teach both Jewish studies, the whole length and breadth of Jewish studies, again, small liberal arts college model, right? But also to teach early Christianity. So that the fact that I was, the old paradigm was you got your scholar of New Testament and early Christianity, and of course they can cover Old Testament too, right? So my position at Bates actually is a function of a real kind of intervention or flipped paradigm. By which you it's no longer unheard of that you will find somebody whose sort of center of gravity and specialty is ancient Judaism teaching the courses in New Testament and early Christianity and the like. When I teach New Testament, New Testament mm-hmm. is Jewish studies, okay, in this paradigm. Most of the authors in the New Testament of the major writings, some of the Gospels, you know, the letters of Paul, etc., Revelation, those authors are obviously Jewish Jesus believers, which makes New Testament part of the purview of Jewish studies. As for teaching my book, yeah, I think it would be a great intro to Jewish studies. We don't currently have a course, so I was in conversation with students as well as other professional scholars, but as I was writing this book, I wasn't creating a course text, but. Because we didn't have such a course, Introduction to Jewish Studies, but I think it really would. Maybe I'll build a course around it. But I think it would, I think, and you know, this might sound like hubris, but I don't mean it in that way, obviously. But I think it would be a great book. It would be great in a sort of introduction to liberal arts text, as a liberal arts text, because of its multidisciplinary structure and context and the way in which it models the, you know, engaging of a variety of disciplines and ways of asking questions, you know, that really bring together ethnography and cultural studies and rhetoric and literature and area studies and ancient history, classical studies, you know, the whole range. So, I don't have, just as I don't think my method in writing this book is necessarily replicatable, because it's so impressionistic in a sense. I mean, I think the analytical elements are strong. I don't want to say I'm just, you know, I just, you know, wrote a collage. But at the same time, there is, it's a very sort of idiosyncratic process. I think again, how people would teach this book or the kinds of contexts in which, professors could imagine using this book, would also be similarly, you know, wide ranging. And I've actually heard from some colleagues that they have been using the book or are using the book in courses. But I haven't gotten the sort of after the fact. I haven't gotten so how did it go yet? So I'm actually looking forward to that. But if you guys have any ideas, I'd love to. Love to hear. I think it would be a good like first text or foundational text for an introduction to Jewish studies.
I also think it would be amazing to have the book as a liberal arts textbook. It's kind of a intro to, I mean, normally, well, we're at UChicago and these are often phrased as Western civilization courses. And it would be very interesting to study Western civilization through the lens of the uses and abuses of Jew as a word. And yeah, it sounds amazing.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I mean, talk about, you know, from margin to center, right? It really would provide, I personally think it would provide a lovely example. Again, we're in the small liberal arts setting like I'm in, we don't tend to have those sort of large survey approaches that you find at larger universities, but I still think, I'm on sabbatical next year, and I might well use that time to really think about whether a course on Introduction to Jewish Studies would fly at a small liberal arts college, and what it would look like, and you know how it might fit into our curriculum in that setting.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. As we wrap up over here, I feel like we've taken up quite a bit of your time. Can you just maybe tell us a little bit more? Do you have any future projects in the works? Anything that's sort of capturing your interest right now that you can share with us?
Well, let's see, a couple of things. You way back at the beginning when we first started talking, you asked if there were things that got left out of this book that were hard to let go. And my one of those things that that runs throughout the book: attention to gender, attention to women's experience, attention to how masculinity, ideas about masculinity or femininity or proper gender roles and sexuality and those ways in which what we call race or ethnicity, what we think of as class, what we think of as nation, how those sorts of things co-construct each other, gender, class, race, nation, so forth. I think that's always visible, or that's a thread that runs through the book. In particular, given that my first book was so explicitly devoted to gender, examining gender, the dynamics of gender, and the emergence of Jewishness, or at least rabbinic Jewishness, and that a number of my articles throughout my career have likewise, writing this book on Jew, these questions of gender appear and are highlighted in parts 1, 2, and 3. They're scattered throughout the book, but any kind of sustained attention, right? It's sort of hit and run attention here and there. So I considered writing a whole section on Jewess, that word, which is, again, it's related to the word Jew. It is not the same at all. And in fact, when my book was discussed in a panel at the Association for Jewish Studies conference, not this past December, but the previous December, it had just come out. And one of the first questions after the panelists presented came from Amy Jill Levine, who wrote a wonderful article a number of years ago now, which had the word Jewess in the title. So she stood up and she asked, so what about Jewess?
Yeah.
So both my deep commitment to, I didn't write the Jewess piece of this book because it would have been, the ladies' gallery, right? It would have been an annex to the book on Jew. And I didn't want to do that. So one of the things I'm working on right now is really is thinking about how to write the Jewess book, how to write the book that really keeps a sustained focus on what we call intersectionality, what we call the co-constituting, the co-constituting of Jewishness and gender and class and nation and Jewishness and that stuff in a way that I really wasn't able, don't feel like I was able to do in this book, Jew. So that's one piece, the sort of gendering, a more sustained gendering of Jew, or Jewing of gender, if you will. I could just leave it there. There I have a few other things on back burners, if you're interested in hearing about them, but I feel like I've also taken up quite a bit of your time and talked an awful lot, already.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. We want to thank you so much for agreeing to this interview, and thank you for the incredible book. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and I'm glad you liked the book. As you can tell, I still very much do, and it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for some wonderful questions.
Thank you. Thanks.